Welcome. This is James Corbett of Global Research TV at grtv.ca with this week's Global Research feature interview, reminding the listeners and viewers once again that this video interview series is also available as an audio podcast, and the link to subscribe to that podcast will be available in the video description for this video. But this week, we're excited to have on the line with us Tom Secker, the documentary filmmaker behind the highly popular 7-7 documentary, 7-7 Seeds of Destruction, and the newly released 7-7 documentary, 7-7 Crime and Prejudice, which is available on Global Research TV at grtv.ca. So, Tom Secker, it's always great to talk with you. Thank you so much for coming on with us today.
Yeah, good to talk to you again, James. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, well, so am I. As I'm sure people who have seen some of your work before or seen interviews with you, you're quite a well-researched person, and you bring a lot of, I think, solid facts to a topic that sometimes does stray into rather speculative areas, and I think that's a breath of fresh air, and it's good to see such a well-documented piece of work coming out. So I'm quite excited about the documentary itself and talking about the different aspects that you raise in it. But to start out, I guess, on something of a devil's advocate type footing or something like that, I'd like to start with this kind of justify your existence question. It seems 7-7 is a area that's been well explored by many different documentaries so far, and I guess just in the last couple of years since your first 7-7 documentary, Seeds of Deconstruction, came out, I guess the question is what really has changed, or what new information do you have to justify an entirely new feature-length documentary on the subject?
Well, I mean, the most of the new information came from the 7-7 inquests that took place from October last year to, they finished in May this year, I think the final conclusion was given. And I'd always intended, if the first film went down well, if it was well received, if you know, people appreciated what it was that I was trying to accomplish with it, I'd always intended to do a follow-up film. Either a sort of remake or adjustment, re-edit of the original one. But, I mean, following the 7-7 inquests, and in particular following the July 7th Truth Campaign's inquests blog, I thought, you know, there's abundant new questions that have been posed by this. There's a lot of new evidence. I mean, we probably have more evidence, new evidence now, than we did in September of last year before the inquests started. There is thousands of pages of testimony. There are hundreds and hundreds of pages of exhibits, and I thought there's certainly enough in here for a new film. It's also that there were other aspects to the whole 7-7 issue that I didn't really cover in the first film. The first film looked at the history of Black Ops and looked at the Home Office narrative of what happened on 7-7 and basically asked the question, given all the problems with this narrative, is it possible that 7-7 was another one of these kinds of black ops? Whereas in this one, I focused slightly less on the Home Office narrative and slightly more on the police investigation, because that's, in many respects, even more important. There's a lot of talk in the 7-7 movement about the need for a public inquiry, and I certainly support an independent public inquiry. If we could ever get one, it would be a great thing to have. But there is another option here, and that is to try and get the police investigation reopened so that they could start looking at some of the fresh evidence. And again, not that likely to happen, but there are historical precedents. There are reasons to be optimistic that that could actually be a realistic goal. So I thought, in this follow-up film, I would look at some of the other things to do with, say, Northern Ireland and what have you, that also provide context to all of this, but also look specifically at the police investigation, the new evidence from the inquests, and see where I could come to with all of it, and see if, you know, once again, I could try and raise some interest in this and try and get people thinking about it.
That's right, and the documentary does raise a lot of interesting questions that I haven't really delved deeply into before, so I was quite thankful for that. And I think just as in Seeds of Deconstruction, I think one of the interesting aspects that really caught my attention the first time I viewed that was the fact that even which trains and traveling in which directions had been affected by these blasts was not exactly nailed down even in the official version of events. I thought what was interesting I thought what was interesting in 7-7 Crime and Prejudice was that even the diagrams and schematics that eventually came out about what where the bombs took place in each train carriage and where people were standing. There's massive discrepancies between that and the various witnesses and things like that. Perhaps you can talk about some of those discrepancies, because it seems that, again, the 7-7 inquest actually raised more questions than it answered in many respects.
Oh, I mean, it certainly raised more questions than it answered. It didn't even answer the fundamental questions it was supposed to be answering, the questions it is obliged by law to be answering. I mean, that was supposed to be the whole purpose of holding the inquests, but they seem to have forgotten all about that almost from day one and just used it as a massive propaganda exercise. Particularly the issue of where the bombs were in the carriages. One of the reasons I focused on this, and one of the reasons why that's something that in the inquests I was particularly keen to see, was there has been this this theory, if you like, that the bombs weren't inside backpacks, they weren't carried onto the trains, they weren't left in bags on the trains or anything like that, but were somehow built into them, built into the floor or strapped underneath the trains or whatever. And now, we don't have any particularly solid physical evidence of this, but certainly the predominance of eyewitness statements are more consistent with that than with an explosion inside the train and bursting out. So when the Metropolitan Police entered a series of diagrams into the evidence at the inquests, and these detailed things like where each individual passenger was supposed to have been standing or sitting at the point of the explosion, where the bodies then ended up after the explosion, and you know, how the recovery process came to find these people. That is what's supposed to be explained in these diagrams. But there's huge contradictions between those, the Metropolitan Police official story, if you like, and what the Home Office narrative says. Let's take Aldgate, the train going from Liverpool Street to Aldgate Station. There's a lot of other problems with that, but let's assume for the sake of argument there was one explosion on that train. It's supposed to have taken place by Shehzad Tanweer using a backpack bomb sat down at the rear of the train. That's what the Home Office narrative says. Now, at the inquests, they did have a witness who called Michael Henning, who was in the next carriage along from where the explosion happened, and he said he saw a man sitting in roughly the seat where the Home Office narrative says Tanweer was. But the problem is his description doesn't fit Tanweer. He admits he couldn't identify the man positively. He just was sort of aware of someone being in that location. And the other major problem is that according to the Metropolitan Police, the explosion didn't take place, as you would expect, in the sort of floor in front of that seat, but in fact around the corner in the standing area. And that's where all of the people who died were apparently also standing. So you have a distance of only several feet, maybe, but nonetheless, it's a big enough difference that you have to wonder, why is it that the Home Office narrative has Tanweer placed in a seat where he clearly couldn't have been sitting if he set off that bomb? There is also the issue that the man who was actually sat in that seat, who Michael Henning apparently saw, was a guy called William Walsh. And William Walsh suffered relatively minor injuries in this explosion, even though he was supposed to only be a few feet away from it. You also have another witness from the next carriage along, a woman called Elizabeth Kenworthy, whose interviews and statements I've featured in both of my films, because I consider her a reliable witness. I mean, she was an off-duty police officer. She is someone who is trained in retention of information. She is trained in observation. You would think her statement of all of these people's would probably be among the more accurate. Now, her testimony and her diagrams that she drew of what she found when she entered this carriage after the explosion shows, you know, large damage to the floor in front of that seat where William Walsh was, but also large damage around the corner in the standing area where Tanweer supposedly was. And furthermore, it shows another hole on the other side of the carriage, further up the carriage, some, I don't know, maybe 25 feet away, 20 feet away, something like that. So it's very difficult to see how one single explosion of a small device in a backpack put on the floor could cause a crater in the floor there, sort of rip the floor up several feet away and blast another hole in the other side of the carriage 20 feet away. I mean, the implication of this is presumably that there were more devices, or that the devices hit those trains in some other way. And of course, that would mean that those four men weren't responsible, because they didn't, you know, if those weren't backpack explosions, then those guys didn't cause it by carrying backpacks onto them. And you get the same kind of issue at on the Piccadilly line explosion between King's Cross and Russell Square. They say that the explosion took place in the standing area. That's what the narrative says. And fair enough, the police diagram does show an explosion in the standing area. But one of the main problems is a man, I think he was the duty station manager at Russell Square, who entered the train sometime after the explosion. He draws another crater several feet away between rows of seats. And also, where they found Jermaine Lindsay's ID, his, you know, wet letters and driving license and whatever, and also where they apparently found his body, is some, I don't know, 15, 20 feet away. There's an entire row of seats in between the standing area where the explosion is supposed to have happened and where they found the effects and his body, that, and from that they draw the conclusion that he caused the explosion. Now, of course...
And am I to understand correctly, because it sounded like from the narration in your documentary that the Jermaine Lindsay's personal effects were somehow separate from his body, because you posit that he sort of deposited the things on the ground and moved over and planted the backpack and then ended up on the floor next to his personal items. So were they physically removed from his pockets?
Well, what they were suggesting, they had an explosives expert, a man called Dr. Clifford Todd, who has appeared in many various instances of this story about 7-7. They had him testifying at the inquests, and he's from, I think he's from Port and Down. He's, you know, government explosives expert, basically. And he described how the items that they found, that the identifying items for Lindsay, showed no sign of explosion damage, and so he postulated that they had been deliberately separated, that i.e. they had sort of got onto the trains, scattered the items on the floor, and then wandered off some distance before setting off the bomb, which doesn't make a huge amount of sense for various reasons. I mean, for one thing, these men are supposed to be Islamic suicide bombers. They are supposed to not be caring about their identity in this world because they are embracing the, you know, the afterlife, and they're becoming martyrs to whatever cause it is they're supposed to have believed in. So why would they be so desperate to make sure that they were identified quickly after the bombs have gone off? And in particular, on the Piccadilly line one, you would have Jermaine Lindsay having to muscle his way past 20 or 30 people who are standing or sitting in the areas where he must have moved through for this story to have made sense, and none of them remember seeing him. Now, is it really plausible, stood on a crowded tube train, that someone's going to push their way past you, having just chucked their wallet and whatever on the floor, pushed their way past you, shoved their way into the middle of the carriage, gone down onto the floor, taken their rucksack off, blown themselves up, and no one sees any of this? No one remembers any of this. It doesn't add up. It simply doesn't add up. And it's the same kind of thing with the Edgware Road bombing, but even more so, because there, it seems that this explosion or explosions, whatever happened there, didn't just blow one hole in the floor of the carriage, but blew as many as 5, 6, maybe 7 holes in the floor of this carriage. And we're talking from one end of the carriage to the other. They were so spread out. And again, I cannot for the life of me see how one explosion in a rucksack is going to destroy almost the entire floor of a tube carriage. It doesn't make sense. So again, the implication is those explosions were caused by some other means than a rucksack-bearing suicide bomber.
Indeed. Well, another, I think, key part of the investigation that your documentary explores is the idea that there was a wider conspiracy than just the four people, which a lot of the evidence seems to point to, and which, unfortunately, the inquest ruled against quite out of hand, I think. So perhaps you can go through some of the evidence that seems to suggest that there was more than simply the four people who have been accused of the crime.
Well, I mean, you have these four alleged bombers. Three of them are supposed to have left Leeds on the morning of 7-7 at about 3 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning. They stopped by, according to the Home Office narrative, they stopped by their bomb factory, they pick up their rucksacks and their various bomb-making equipment and shove them into the back of a car, drive down to Luton Station where they meet up with the fourth man, and then catch a train to London and from there supposedly carry out these bombings. Okay. The thing is, at each individual point on this journey, Leeds, Luton Station, and King's Cross in London, you have witnesses who apparently identified these men, but saw them with other people at the same time. So up in Leeds, you have this older woman called Sylvia Waugh, who lived in Alexandra Grove, which is the area, the street where this bomb factory supposedly was. And she described how she was woken up on the morning of 7/7 at whatever, 4 o'clock in the morning. She looks out the window and she sees a group of Asian guys putting rucksacks into the back of a car. The problem is, she says that there were as many as 5 or 6 men when there should have only been 3. There should just be Mohammed Sadiq Khan, Shahzad Tanweer, Haseeb Hussain. Yet she says there were 2 cars that drove off, and she says that there were, I think, 4 men in one car and 2 men in the other. So from where, you know, where did these other 3 people come from, and who were they, and what role were they playing in this? Obviously, there are several different possibilities. They may have been co-conspirators, they may have been, you know, terrorist masterminds or something, or they may have been handlers, they may have been people who were there to make sure that this went down, to make sure that those guys turned up that morning and picked up something from that flat so that they could then be linked to it and they could call it a bomb factory and construct this story that probably isn't true. I don't know, obviously, which of those possibilities it is, but both of those are very much open at this point. So they drive down the M1. They reach Luton Station. They park up in Luton Station, meet up with Jermaine Lindsay, and then they supposedly assemble their bombs from their various bomb-making equipment in the boot of this Nissan Micra, which in itself is an absurd notion. I mean, why on earth would anyone who was planning a suicide bombing put together their bombs in a train station car park in front of everyone, in front of CCTV cameras, where at any point someone could come and arrest them and stop them? Doesn't add up again. But one of the people who was in Luton Station car park at the same time was a woman called Sue Clark, who arrived at about 7:15 to see these guys huddled around the boot of this car and obviously up to something. And again, the problem is, when she first spoke to the police, I think it was 4 or 5 days after 7/7, she said that there was, again, more than 4 men, as many as 5 or 6, that there were at least 4 in the Nissan Micra, when there should have only been 3, and there were at least 2 in the Fiat Brava, when there should have been only 1. So were these the same men as who were seen in Leeds? Were they others? Were they ever traced? You know, this is the sort of thing that I mean, that this isn't just about the Home Office narrative, it's about the plausibility of the police investigation. Why is it that those extra men were never traced? And a strange thing about Sue Clark's testimony at the inquests is, by the time she gets to the inquests, nearly, well, about 5.5 years after all of this happened, her statement has somewhat changed, and now she only remembers 3 men in one car and 1 in the other, so it fits in with the Home Office narrative. So what's happened to, if you like, affect her memory in the meantime? Well, various things have happened. They've told her that there were only 4 men and there could have only been 4 men, and it's all a little bit like Lee Harvey Oswald. So they then catch this train, and we have all the problems with the time of the train, but okay, let's say they caught the 7:25 from Luton. That's not what the Home Office narrative says, but it is what the police say. Once again, they contradict each other. They turn up in London, they get to King's Cross Station, they are about to supposedly split up and catch these different trains and blow themselves up. They are witnessed, once again, by a man called Joseph Martocchia. Now, he is obliquely referred to in the Home Office narrative. The narrative speaks of a witness seeing these men hugging shortly before they split up, saying they were almost euphoric. Now, obviously, this is it's designed to give you the impression that these men were off on some, you know, religious fanatical martyrdom mission, and they were sort of saying their final goodbye before they split up to do this. But once again, the problem is, Joseph Martocchia saw as many as 6 men. Once again, 6. It seems that we have 6 people at each stage of this journey, when we're supposed to have 3, then 4, then 4. So, and his descriptions of these men don't really fit too well with the alleged bombers, or at least with the CCTV of the alleged bombers that morning. So whether he even saw those men or saw someone else, we can't be certain. But it only leaves 2 possibilities. Either he did see them, in which case he saw an extra couple of men stood around hugging with them and talking to them, or he didn't see them, in which case his testimony is completely irrelevant to anything. And so if one were investigating a crime and one has these four suspects and one has within a few days of the attacks witnesses at three different points in their journey saying there was at least one, if not two, extra men alongside them, surely tracing those extra men would be a matter of utmost priority. Yet, when they got to the inquests, the police just sort of shrugged their shoulders and said, oh, well, we kind of looked, we kind of asked, but we never found anything, so we gave up on it. And that's ridiculous. In a crime, you know, a mass murder on that scale, to have just sort of, oh, well, we couldn't find out who they were, it's not good enough. And it's either a lie or it's just pathetic. Either way, I don't see why we should believe them.
Well, surely if there had been other people involved, we would have seen them on CCTV cameras that morning, right, Tom?
Well, we would have if any of the CCTV cameras were actually working. Or if the CCTV actually made any sense. There are numerous problems. I didn't really get into this in the film because it's rather technical. There is a piece on my blog about this, though, that basically goes through the lengthy piece of CCTV we have from Luton Station, from the car park in Luton Station that morning and from inside the station, and comparing it sort of point by point, stage by stage with the Home Office narrative. And they've kept telling us that, you know, the time codes on some of these cameras are wrong, and they've kind of fudged it and sort of never really been clear as to how accurate this CCTV is supposed to be. But in any case, it doesn't follow. It doesn't fit with the government's narrative. You either have things happening at the wrong time, or you have cameras sort of out of time at one moment and then magically bang on time for the next moment. Then you get to London and the CCTV is a joke. You have one camera from King's Cross, Thameslink, showing the men walking towards the underground. And apparently the reason why that we have this is because the temporary King's Cross CCTV system at that point was faulty. It bust. Something went wrong with it, and it got frozen for magically for half an hour or so on that one camera that just so happened to catch those four men at that point. There is nothing beyond that point showing them any closer to any of these targeted trains that then blew up. So there's nothing showing them walking towards it, nothing showing them getting on it, nothing showing Hasib Hussain what he was doing for about 25 minutes. He then first appears on CCTV sort of outside King's Cross at about 8:55. So for a good 25, 30 minutes, he's just, well, doing whatever he's doing. We have no idea. So the thing is that really kind of wrenched my guts when I was reading this in the inquests is that the police were trying to portray this as somehow a stroke of fortune. They said, you know, it was so lucky that the system got stuck on that one camera, and so we got that picture of those four men walking through with their rucksacks at, you know, 8:30 in the morning. And they were trying to portray this as though, you know, it was a stroke of luck, and that's how they managed to identify these four men, and how great it was that the system had malfunctioned, when the reality is they should have been gutted that the system had malfunctioned. They should have been very angry with the people responsible for running that system, if indeed it did malfunction, which, well, probably didn't, but they should have been very angry about this, and they should have been, you know, demanding that someone be held accountable for the fact that of, you know, for the key half hour that morning, they have about 5 seconds of relevant footage. And I felt that was a disgraceful attitude for the police to try and pull that one in an inquest that's supposed to be determining how 52 people died. Again, it's a pathetic attitude for them to have, and they should be ashamed.
A failure of such wonderful fortune for the investigators, right? Yeah. No, of course, I think the absurdity of that would strike anyone. But I guess the examination of the police investigation forms something of the centerpiece of the documentary, and it's kind of at its heart in terms of just its placement in the sort of middle part of the documentary. But what strikes me is really the meat and potatoes of the documentary is your examination of both historical and even literary and pop culture analogs of various stories that we know, narratives of bombers throughout history and throughout literature, as I say, acting in various ways that don't necessarily subscribe to what we've been told told about the narrative of the 7-7 bombers. So we're looking at ideas of unintentional suicide bombers or suicide bombers who have somehow been manipulated or coerced into doing what they're doing. Lots of very interesting examples of that, and I'd like to start going through some of that. But I guess to start that discussion, for some of the more incredulous people in the audience, perhaps you can talk about why we should have any doubts about the motives or intentions of these four alleged bombers, especially since we have so much evidence that's come out since connecting these bombers to other alleged terrorists in other alleged plots, and also things like Mohammed Sadiq Khan's martyrdom video.
Well, I mean, the videos, you have one of Shahzad Tanweer and one of Mohammed Sadiq Khan. And these videos appeared, the Khan one appeared, I think, in September 2005, a few weeks after 7-7. And Shahzad Tanweer's one appeared on the eve of the first anniversary of 7-7. And these are the relatively standard, you know, Muslim lad sat there with a thing wrapped around his head and a whatever hanging behind him, talking about jihad and talking about, you know, the corrupt West and all the rest of it. But at no point in any of these videos did either man really make explicit any intention to commit suicide. There are some indications that they were planning on fighting, perhaps as part of the Afghan insurgency, fighting against the West in that way. But there's no mention of tube trains, there is no mention of suicide bombings, there is no real mention of martyrdom at all. So to call them, even to call them martyrdom videos is a misnomer, a misrepresentation. I mean, I'm sure when you were talking then, you were sort of talking in inverted commas, but the mainstream media haven't had that subtlety to them as far as they are concerned. These videos are absolute proof of these men's intentions. But okay, even if we accepted those two videos in that way, which I think is misinterpreting them, what about the other two men? If this was part of some great terrorist conspiracy where these four men had sort of all radicalized each other and convinced each other that suicide bombing was the only way to go, then why didn't they record these videos together? And if you look at the setup of these two videos and the backdrops in them, it appears that Khan and Tanweer probably recorded these videos at about the same time and possibly even in the same place. But we don't know when that time was and where that place was. So they are of unknown provenance, basically. We don't know the origin of this information, and the information itself doesn't really support the Home Office narrative, except in a relatively superficial way, in a news media-friendly kind of way. And, of course, maybe that was the point.
Do we know where these videos were supposedly discovered, how they came to light?
I think the Mohammed Sadiq Khan one was first shown on Al Jazeera, and it was, I don't believe they've ever given a kind of conclusive story as to how they got it. It appears to have been posted to them, and it was intercut with video footage of Ayman Zawahiri talking about whatever it was that Ayman Zawahiri happened to be talking about that day, and of, you know, people playing around with test tubes and things and making it look like, you know, a propaganda, Al-Qaeda propaganda video. But of course, as with so many of these Al-Qaeda propaganda videos, they don't really add up as terrorist propaganda. They seem to serve the purposes of the West far more than they could ever serve the purposes of some rogue bunch of Islamic terrorists. And I think that's probably the best interpretation available to us of the videos regarding 7-7. So we have a lack of intent, a lack of evidence of intent, which is quite fundamental in a criminal investigation. You would have to prove that these people wanted to kill themselves and intended and planned to kill themselves in order to demonstrate that they were intentional, conventional suicide bombers. Now, you also have these various different terrorist tactics that have been used in both real bombings and in simulations in, you know, literature and film and TV shows and what have you. And among those is the Irish proxy bombers as part of the war in Northern Ireland. And this may have even been a tactic that MI5 innovated. What they would tend to do is they'd get their proxy, who would actually often be a member of the people that they were fighting, and the Republican terrorists would threaten this man and, you know, beat him up and maybe torture him and maybe threaten his family or basically do whatever they needed to do in order to force this guy to become a suicide bomber so that they would, you know, handcuff him to the steering wheel of a car and tell him, drive it into this British Army military checkpoint. And several of these bombings were actually carried out. This wasn't just a sort of hypothetical thing or something they attempted. Some of these were successful in the early mid-90s. These attacks were very real. They seem to have been abandoned around 96, 97, because, as you can imagine, it's a rather horrific thing to do to someone. Well, it's an extremely horrific thing to do to someone. And in propaganda terms, it worked against them. It, you know, won them more enemies than friends to do terrorism in that way. But it does leave the door open to the possibility of maybe these four were somehow duped. Maybe they thought they were carrying something else and they were actually given bombs. Or maybe they were given some sort of, oh, I don't know. I mean, I'm speculating here, but I'm just sort of trying to surround these possibilities with a bit more detail. Maybe they were given some sort of tracking device that would then set off a bomb once they got close enough to it, say. I mean, these are all just possibilities, but they are possibilities that are borne out to some extent by very real historical precedents and also by the portrayal of terrorism in these various books and films and so on.
Well, perhaps you can go through some more of the historical examples of suicide bombings that you go through in the documentary.
Well, I mean, the case that most fascinates me and is one that hardly anyone seems to know about is that of the French anarchist Marshal Bourdin, who is, by the official historical record, he is actually Britain's first suicide bomber. But he was completely forgotten about because when 7/7 happened, for days afterwards, the media were going around saying this is Britain's first suicide bombing. So clearly they didn't know about him or were just ignoring that case. But I think it's most likely they didn't know about him because he's not very well known about. He was a French anarchist. He was part of the late 19th century sort of Victorian anarchist movement that came out of Marxism and the early labour movement in Britain. Well, not just in Britain, but across Europe, really. And in February 1894, he somehow manages to blow himself up in Greenwich Park on a hill leading up to the Greenwich Royal Observatory. He is found with, I think, both of his hands blown off with a big hole sort of blasted in his stomach. He is still just about alive and lives for maybe 20 or 30 minutes after the explosion. But all he'll say to people is sort of, take me home. That's what he was reported as saying, was take me home. And he wouldn't explain what had happened. He wouldn't explain what he was trying to accomplish. There is nothing further from Marshal Bourdin himself that gives us any sense of what was happening here. But he was found with quite a substantial amount of money in his pockets, in I think the form of gold coins, which strongly suggests he wasn't trying to kill himself. I mean, it wouldn't make any sense to carry a load of gold with you if you're going to go and blow yourself up. So we are looking at several other possibilities. Did he blow himself up by accident? Was he carrying a bomb on the way to the observatory and planning to bomb the Greenwich Observatory? And this may sound absurd, but if you understand anarchism and you understand the role that the Greenwich Observatory plays in the centralization of global time, it is the line through which Greenwich Mean Time is basically, you know, designated and organized. It is precisely the sort of centralized modernist institution the anarchists would hate. So it does, to some extent, make sense that they might have been trying to blow it up. So was Bourdin on his way there, trying to blow it up, maybe leave the bomb there and Scarpa, and it went off prematurely, or he tripped up and caused it to go off somehow, and maybe his death was an accident, an unintentional suicide bombing, if you like. There is also the possibility that he didn't even know that he was carrying a bomb. And there are suggestions that his brother-in-law, who was actually a special branch police informant for some time, and specifically at the time that this explosion happened, that his brother-in-law may indeed have set him up, may have told him he was carrying something else, given him a bomb, and that once again it presumably went off too early or something went wrong and he ended up dying. And there are sort of variations on this story as well, such as he was delivering the bomb to other French anarchists who were planning to use it for whatever atrocity they were planning on using it for, and once again that he may have tripped over or dropped it or something like that. And all of these were speculated on, and all of these were kind of outlined in various things like police, special branch police memoirs. There's two different special branch police officers from that time who published memoirs in newspapers talking about this in the years afterwards. And they suggest two different accounts. One says he was delivering a bomb to some anarchists. The other one says someone had accused him of being a spy himself and that he had set out to prove that he was a hardcore, you know, a rebel and accidentally ended up killing himself. And of course, any of these are possible. It's very difficult 100 years later, 115 years later, to figure this one out. But I think the crucial lesson in the Marshall Bourdain story for me, and its most obvious relevance to 7-7, was the way in which it was surrounded almost instantly by conspiracy theories, by speculation of a wider plot or some kind of, you know, bigger plot that went horribly wrong. And it was also simulated. It was put into the form of fiction in Joseph Conrad's book, The Secret Agent, which itself was then adapted by Alfred Hitchcock in a movie called Sabotage. The Secret Agent was, I think, 1906, and Sabotage was 1936. So quite a long time after the actual explosion. But still, it almost became a predilection, an obsession of popular culture to try and get to grips with what the hell had happened here. And the way we tried to get to grips with it was by sort of speculating in the form of fiction. Now, in The Secret Agent, Conrad very much pursues the notion that Bourdain was set up by his brother-in-law, who was a police informant. In Sabotage, Hitchcock implies that the guy didn't even know he was carrying a bomb, because in that form of the story, Marshall Bourdain, who was, I think, about 25 when he died, has been kind of transmogrified into a 12-year-old boy, and the boy is given a parcel to deliver to a train station, a tube underground, London Underground station, by this terrorist in London, who is trying to bomb the place himself, but he is being watched by the police, and so he sets up this slightly dim-witted brother-in-law of his to go and do the job for him. But the boy dawdles and gets distracted, and so he catches a bus to try and make it to the station on time, runs out of time, the bomb explodes, destroys the bus, kills everyone on it. So the parallels with 7-7 are rather obvious. Targeting a tube station, targeting a bus, you know, someone who has blown up on a bus but may have not even known that they were carrying a bomb at the time. You know, these sort of memes and these kinds of ideas were already established, you know, long, long before 7-7 even happened. And so I think this forms the basis of perhaps a way into understanding how the same sorts of processes of simulating terrorist attacks of various kinds occurs in modern fiction, and in particular in that fiction which most closely replicates what happened on 7-7. So you have, starting in, I think, 2002, you have a whole bunch of episodes of the BBC spy drama, Spooks. It's known as MI5 in its foreign form because, you know, the word spooks has certain racist connotations in America, so they don't use that title. And this is a spy drama. It is based around MI5 agents supposedly trying to stop terrorist attacks and getting up to all sorts of dirty shenanigans along the way. But also, you have a couple of documentaries. You have the rather well-known Panorama programme called London Under Attack, which had a kind of panel of experts responding to a fictional terrorist attack that was very, very similar to 7-7, very similar indeed. You also have a BBC HBO film production called Dirty War. And again, on my blog, I've put up links to all of these episodes and all of these films where I've been able to find them online so that people can go and watch the whole thing if they want to. And what you have in these things is a sort of, again, a kind of mixture of different memes in various different combinations that in some way replicated what then eventually happened on 7-7. And most of these films and TV shows and what have you took place before 7-7. So they had the effect, and I'm not saying this was an intentional thing, I'm not saying this was part of some kind of propagandist plot. It may have been, it may not have been, but it certainly had the effect of conditioning people to believe not only the official conspiracy theory, the one about four Muslim suicide bombers, but also some of the alternative conspiracy theories, such as they were you know, set up as part of the terrorism training exercise and what have you. So if we look at some of this, we have, as far as I know, the first ever depiction of a Islamic Muslim suicide bombing in Britain on British television actually took place in, I think, early 2003 in an episode of Spooks. A young Muslim lad is sort of manipulated by a cleric, a radical cleric, into blowing himself up in Birmingham. So we have this meme planted in the consciousness of the British public long before the event even happened. We also have MI5 staging an attack, i.e. faking an attack, against a London tube station. And the station that they chose was Broad Street Station, which is basically Liverpool Street Station, old version. It's a disused station now, but it's right next door to Liverpool Street. You also have a episode in July 2003, on the 7th of July 2003, for those that are into numerology, where MI5 are carrying out a terrorism training exercise, and during the exercise, an attack for real actually happens, though it turns out in a twist at the end of the episode that it's all been simulated. It was all just part of the exercise all along. So again, we have this notion of attack coinciding with exercise, which is something that has happened for real on several occasions. But again, we have that sort of particular conspiracy theory being presented to the public before the event then happens for real on 7/7, where you have these supposed suicide bombings happening at the same time as Peter Power, management consultant, is running a terrorism training exercise that's based around a, broadly speaking, very similar scenario. So, were we being manipulated? The question, I suppose, for me is, if this was all intentional, if this was a deliberate conditioning of the public and preparing of the public, then we haven't only been prepared for the official conspiracy theory. We have also been prepared for the alternative, or at least some of the alternative conspiracy theories. And so, if that's what they were trying to do, what is the implication for us, for people in, you know, independent investigators, citizen investigators, truth movement activists, whatever? Are we sort of being sent down a cul-de-sac, or being sent down a sort of to follow a trail of breadcrumbs that doesn't go anywhere or leads to a mousetrap or whatever? I don't know the answer to that. I can't be certain. But I feel it's something people should be considering when they go into this and when they investigate it for themselves.
I understand what you're saying here, but it does seem just such a disappointing or a disheartening conclusion to come to say that we don't know the answer to that. I don't want to leave that as a rhetorical question, because it seems to raise something that seems to be at the very heart of the matter. If there is some sort of overarching conspiracy to implant this meme in the pop culture before and after the events in order to condition us to expect some sort of alternative narrative, then how can that not imply that there is some sort of grander conspiracy that's functioning at least broadly in the ways that the alternative narrative would consider it to be functioning? I mean, what would be the point of implanting that, and what could it possibly be obfuscating in terms of hiding from what was really happening that day?
Well, the reason why I say that I'm uncertain, I'm not saying we cannot know this. I'm saying, given the research that I've done into it, I've got to this point. I have not been able to get any further. I have not been able to establish with any greater certainty that if this was a deliberate conditioning plot, if you like, then who was responsible for it? Because I haven't really been able to find any proper connections between the people producing these various different shows and who was writing them and who was acting in them. If there were those connections, I would say so. I would say I found them, and these are the people we should be looking into in order to try and make more sense of this. But I couldn't find them, so I cannot offer a conclusion for which I have no evidence, or at least I don't think it would be very honest to do so. So I certainly think people should pursue that line of inquiry. I mean, obviously, if I didn't have that suspicion, I wouldn't have devoted 20 minutes of the film to exploring it. But I cannot be certain at this stage, because I don't have that information. Now, yeah, sure, if there was some kind of plot to implant these memes in different combinations to condition us, to precondition us to respond in a certain way once the attacks had happened, then obviously, yes, of course, that would likewise suggest that the attacks themselves were part of the same conspiracy, were part of the same plot. And I have no problem whatsoever with people looking for those connections and trying to explore that as a possibility. But I think we should also be honest with ourselves that, you know, we can invent a conspiracy theory about anything if we want to. It's a very easy thing to do. That doesn't mean that any particular conspiracy theory is wrong, or that doesn't even mean that doing that is wrong. But we should just be aware of it, that conspiracy theories aren't something that are completely denied by the mainstream. That's quite a popular thing to say in the independent media, that they just ridicule conspiracy theories. But they don't. They propagate them. They propagate both official conspiracy theories about 9/11 or Saddam's weapons of mass destruction or whatever, but they also propagate speculative conspiracy theories in the form of shows like The X-Files and you know, conspiracy thriller films and fiction and all the rest of it. So these aren't things that are sort of completely alien to the mainstream culture. They are actually quite commonly present in the mainstream culture. So we should be careful of, I suppose, leaping on any particular conspiracy theory that has been presented to us by the mainstream. That's what we should be particularly wary of. And that applies to both conspiracy theories in the official sense, where it's always blamed on an outside party, it's always blamed on the rogue state or the terrorists or whoever, but also those conspiracy theories where they are the blame turns inwards, where it is blamed on the police or MI5 or the government in some way. We should treat all of these with skepticism, not as a means of just sort of shrugging your shoulders and saying, oh, well, we'll never find out, so it doesn't really matter, but so that we don't get tricked, so that we don't end up chasing pointless stories and pointless theories for which we don't really have any evidence, and spending, you know, it's wasted effort, it's wasted time. And it's also strategically a bit dim, I think, to leap on a conspiracy theory as an alternative explanation simply because it blames who you think may have been responsible for it. You know, there is the question of who did 7/7, but there is also the question of how it was done. And all too often, people confuse the two. Now, the way I see this situation, or I am increasingly seeing this whole situation, is this is a interrogation. We are the citizens, we are interrogating the state. We suspect that they may have been involved in this horrendous crime, and with good reasons for those suspicions. There are lots of historical precedents, and the official version of this does not make any bloody sense. So that suspicion is perfectly well-founded, and of course I share it. But if you're in an interrogation with a suspect, the state is, in effect, a criminal suspect in this situation. If you're in an interrogation, does it make more sense to march into the interrogation room and say, we know you did it, we know how you did it, and this is how you did it? Because what happens if you've got it wrong? What happens is the suspect sits there and rather smugly thinks, ah, these people aren't as smart as they think they are. They don't really know that I did it. They don't really know how I did it. So if I just shut up and don't really engage them in this, chances are nothing will come of it, because they won't be able to really go anywhere. However, if you march into the interrogation room and you say, we've had a look at your alibi, and in this context, the alibi would be the Home Office narrative, we've had a look at your alibi, and your alibi doesn't make any sense. In fact, some of it is obviously untrue. So, what's going on here? Then that puts the pressure on them to then have to come up with a new explanation and a new alibi. And if you can get them to do this 4 or 5 times, as has sort of happened with the 9/11 situation and the air defences and, excuse me, and NORAD and all of that, then you get to the point where no one's going to bloody believe them anymore, because they're going to have told you 4 or 5 alibis, all of which are nonsense. So I think that strategically makes a lot more sense than marching in there and saying, we know how this was done, when, in truth, we don't know. Not yet. Hopefully we will. Really, hopefully. You know, we can do this. But at this point, with the evidence we have right now, I think it strategically makes a hell of a lot more sense to just knock down their alibi systematically and, you know, doggedly, knock down their alibis and force the pressure onto them to keep talking about this, rather than make an accusation that we can't really back up properly and have them just sort of sit there and say, well, that's not true, so sod off.
Well, that's extremely sage advice, and I really do hope that the listeners and viewers do take that to heart and at least consider it, because it does strike me as counterproductive at times to come in thinking that you know everything about what happened and how it happened and who is to blame, and thus really painting yourself into a corner where if you are wrong, or if you get any part of that story wrong, then your entire theory can be demolished, and it just doesn't seem like it really serves the purpose. So I think that is extremely important to contemplate and to bear in mind. But it also raises, this can get very meta philosophical here, and we can ponder the various layers of thinking that can go on, but it does seem then that a type of, I suppose, meta-conspiracy could be to implant the meme beforehand so that when the attacks happen in the exact way that it was implanted in the media, you can say, well, look, you're just looking at this TV show. Are you insane? This is just a TV show. It's fiction. Why are you positing it? So, for example, with 9/11, we have the Lone Gunman episode where the rogue elements of the government commandeer a commercial airliner by remote control to fly it into the World Trade Center in order to justify wars in the Middle East. And lo and behold, that's very much a conspiracy theory that is propounded about 9/11 these days.
Absolutely.
So again, the question becomes at a certain point, is it valuable I suppose I don't know what question to ask from that, but it does seem that there is something very valuable here to ponder and to research, and you do spend a fair deal of time in the documentary looking at the 7/7 analogs, and it's an interesting subject, but I just don't know where to take it, and I think there are too many levels maybe to really determine at this point. But what would you suggest for people who are interested in pondering that aspect of the crime more deeply or more closely?
Well, I mean, firstly, look into all of these different films and various episodes of TV shows and things that I included in the documentary. There may be others out there that I've missed. I mean, I tried to do a relatively comprehensive job of the things that and cover all the things that I thought were particularly significant. But yeah, go and watch all of these episodes. And also, you brought up the Lone Gunman and 9/11, but there were other TV shows and films that also predicted 9/11 in various ways. There was an episode of Martial Law with Sammo Hung. I think it was the very last episode of the second series, which features a sort of international rogue terrorist group hijacking a series of planes by remote and crashing them into cities. So once again, we have a very similar kind of scenario, and once again, we are presented with a conspiracy theory. There are other films and other real life events, of course, as well, that in some way foreshadowed 9/11. So I think it's important to look at all of these things, and I think it's important to see how we are almost being presented with an argument before an event, about an event, before that event has happened. So we are presented with simulations, fictional depictions that give us an official conspiracy theory and support an official conspiracy theory, and we are also given the same that support alternative conspiracy theories. So if there is a plot here, then I think the aim would be to push us into these two separate groups. So we are just two different mobs, both of which have their own conspiracy theories, and all we're really doing is having a war of conspiracy theories. We aren't really pushing for further investigation. We aren't supporting citizens' investigations like the July 7th Truth Campaign and like the various independents and obviously the groups who have investigated all sorts of other atrocities and other events. We aren't, you know, putting the pressure on the state and putting the pressure on the police to reopen their inquiries. And we aren't really encouraging other people to become sceptical so that when further things like this happen in the future, we're already sceptical of them and we're already in a position to investigate them for ourselves. All of that kind of goes out the window. And all of that's, you know, the most important stuff that we can be doing is those three things: pushing for further public inquiry, supporting citizens' investigations, and encouraging scepticism in the public. Those, to me, are the three aims of all of this, or the three most important aims. But all of that kind of gets forgotten if you get engaged in this rather childish and herd-like dialogue where all you're really doing is trying to argue that your conspiracy theory is ever so slightly better than the government's conspiracy theory. And sure, a lot of them are. But that doesn't mean they're true. It just means they're slightly better than a load of tosh. And is that really a fight worth having? Is that really a fight worth winning? I don't think so. I think we should beware of red herrings. We should beware of cul-de-sacs. I mean, you've investigated plenty of stuff. I've investigated plenty of stuff. Lord knows how much time we have wasted on things that turned out to be nothing or turned out to not be what we initially thought they were and haven't really got us any closer to where we want to be. That's the nature of investigating. I mean, there's nothing you can do about it, really, except try and remain skeptical and try and think, you know, at some point, if you've chased a lead as far as you can take it and it hasn't really gone anywhere, chances are it's not going to go anywhere, and so you're better devoting your time to a different aspect of it. And let me give you a few examples of this that you may disagree with, and I could be completely wrong about this, but with 7-7, we've had a number of things that have almost pushed us in, well, have, I think, pushed us in the direction of conspiracy theories, perhaps deliberately. You have the CCTV image from Luton Station, that sole CCTV image of four guys walking into Luton Station. And it's a terrible quality image. And a lot of people said, it's faked. They positively claimed, this is faked. And even I, for a long time, I looked at that and I thought, yeah, it looks fake. It looks like a Mac job. It looks like someone's stuck it together on Photoshop and not done a very good job. But they sort of pushed us in the direction of saying, therefore, the CCTV must be fake, rather than this is just an incredibly poor quality image that doesn't prove anything. So a lot of people went around saying this CCTV image is fake. And so then, hey presto, when they release a whole bunch of new CCTV, they make all those people look a bit foolish. And they keep this rather childish dialogue and argument going. Because then people are forced into the position where they've either got to say, okay, I was wrong about that. I thought that was fake and it wasn't. Or they're pushed into the position where they say, oh, well, all the CCTV is fake. And I don't even have to prove that any of this is fake. I can just say it because it has to be fake in order for me to maintain my position. And that's a really bad place for people to be if they're trying to investigate something. And it is emotionally awkward for them. It's not, you know, it takes some guts to say, I was wrong about that. I just got it wrong. And a lot of people would rather go down the easy route of just kind of dismissing the whole thing. So you have that. You have the Israeli warning on the morning of 7-7, which may or may not have taken place. But the problem is the various reporting on it is very self-contradictory. You have some reports saying the Israelis received a warning on the morning of 7-7 that basically Scotland Yard, the British police, phoned up the Israeli embassy, warned them about an impending attack, and they then told Benjamin Netanyahu not to leave his hotel. That is one version of this story. Another version of this story is, in fact, that the warning went the other way, from the Israeli embassy to Scotland Yard. You also have a story saying that this warning didn't take place on the morning of 7-7, but actually took place a couple of days before. And again, I think you have stories saying that it was going in both directions. So chances are there was something there that happened, that someone told to a few journalists and caused them to report it. But that doesn't necessarily mean that there was a warning. And yet people do like this because, you know, it's Israel. People like blaming Israel for stuff. Not that Israel is in any way a sort of innocent state. I'm not sort of trying to defend the horrendous things that the Israeli state have done. But they're not responsible for everything. And it is a relatively popular conspiracy meme to blame them for stuff without a huge amount of evidence. And a lot of people leapt on these early stories about this Israeli warning and turned it into a big conspiracy theory. And, you know, at the very best, if that warning took place, it implies foreknowledge. It doesn't imply complicity. There is no evidence whatsoever that the Israelis carried out 7-7. There is some evidence, I suppose, that they knew that it was about to happen. But those two are different things. So again, we may be presented there with something of a red herring. We may be presented with something that is to try and sort of tweak us towards a particular direction that in fact is not going to take us anywhere because it actually may not have anything to do with anything. These are just possibilities. I'm not saying for definite that the Israeli warning was a red herring.
Just to interject, as I'm sure someone will bring up in the comment for this interview, what about the people who were the company that was responsible for running the CCTV system, which so signally failed? Was that an Israeli connected company?
Yes, it was. It was. And if you were looking for, if you are looking for some kind of complicity in this from an Israeli, you know, link, I'd say that connection is a far more sound connection than this one, this sort of rumor of a warning that we're not really sure who sent it and when and to whom. I think the issue of the CCTV, particularly given the failure of the CCTV in such a dramatic way, I think that is a far more worthy of research and far more worthy of suspicion than these rather sort of half-assed reports about warnings that were flashing around that morning. It's not that I'm sort of trying to, like I say, exonerate the Israeli state. It's just I think we should be aware of the fact that they know there is a lot of suspicion towards the Israeli state, and they may well be willing to manipulate that to send us down that route when it might just actually have nothing to do with them. You also have, there were a couple of other examples I was thinking of. You have Harun Aswat. Now, I'm perfectly aware of the fact that plenty of so-called Islamic terrorists or militants or what have you have been working for the security services, CIA, MI6, Pakistani ISI, whoever. They've all got connections to these. And again, I'm not denying that at all. In fact, it forms a core part of my research and my exploration of 7-7. But I think the Aswat thing, the Harun Aswat thing, might be something where they've just sort of, they've pushed us in a direction that has resulted more in obfuscation than it has in clarification. Now, Harun Aswat was, for days after 7-7, for weeks after 7-7, reported as the terrorist mastermind. They said he was in contact with the alleged bombers, that he left Britain on the morning of the explosions, all of this. Now, they've never presented any evidence for this, and the phone records that they have released don't show any calls that would match up with Harun Aswat, or as far as I can tell. And then, at the end of the month, on Fox News, of all channels, we have John Loftus, who works for the Department of Justice, he works for the American government, going on Fox News and saying, Aswat is working for MI6, he's a double agent. Now, normally, if someone working for the US Justice Department went on Fox News and said something, I wouldn't believe it just on the basis that it was someone working for the government saying it on Fox News. Yet because it's the exact sort of thing that people want to hear, terrorist is working for MI6, people almost accepted it without criticism and without skepticism. And so I think what we should be doing here is, like I say, be skeptical of basically all the information that comes in. But obviously you can only go so far with that before you just sort of give up and decide not to do any further with it. But in particular, we should try and apply the same standards to the different sorts of evidence, which means if something is well reported and well substantiated in the mainstream media, then it is well reported and well substantiated. If it is poorly reported and poorly substantiated, as I maintain that Loftus interview is, he doesn't really present any evidence in that. He just makes the claim. So if it is poorly evidenced and poorly substantiated, then it is that. Even if it's telling us something that we sort of think we want to believe, it's still poor reporting. Likewise, in the independent media, if something is well-sourced and well-referenced, and, you know, they've given you as much of the source material as they can, then that's good reporting. But if the independent media just sort of repeat something that they've heard somewhere that sounds suspicious but don't provide any further source or analysis, then that's poor reporting. So I think we should just... The whole point to me of the truth movement, or whatever you want to call this thing, is to try and raise the standard of reporting and the standard of understanding of how the world works. I think you would broadly agree with these aims. But that means praise the mainstream media when it does it right, and praise the independent media when it does it right. It also means criticize the mainstream media when they do it wrong, and criticize the independent media when they do it wrong. So all of those times when this John Loftus interview has been stuck up on a website with a big banner headline, MI6, you know, terrorist mastermind was MI6 agent, I consider that poor reporting, and I consider that a bit naive, and I consider that uncritical, because what we're actually talking about is an alleged terrorist mastermind, and we don't really have any evidence that he was the terrorist mastermind, has been alleged to have been an MI6 agent, because that's all it is an allegation by John Loftus. It's not really substantiated or evidenced by anything that he said in that interview. So these are just examples. I am not absolutely saying any of these are necessarily red herrings or false leads that have been left for us to chase. I am saying these are the sorts of things that, given how long I've been looking into this, I now feel are likely to be red herrings, and that chances are, in this whole story, there certainly will be some red herrings that they've put out there to wind us up, to keep us truth campaigners and truth activists and independent investigators and what have you, filmmakers and so on, to keep us busy on things that are completely irrelevant. So we should always be aware that that is something that's likely to be going on, and from the evidence I think I presented in 7-7 Crime and Prejudice, I would say the evidence suggests it is going on. I would almost say that as a certainty.
Well, you raise, again, so many absolutely really important points and things that I think we do need to ponder at greater length. And there are so many other points in the documentary that I'd like to go over and commend to the listeners and viewers' attention as well, including your discussion of the idea of intelligence failures and how that concept itself can even reinforce the story overall. And so many important things in this documentary, but we run the risk of getting to the point where we've spent as much time discussing it as it would take someone to actually watch the documentary. So at this point, I will once again just commend people to go and watch 7-7 Crime and Prejudice, which again, you can see on Global Research TV at grtv.ca, and to take a look at some of these issues, and again, some of the excellent work you've put in. But in the rather boring and cliched interest of putting the last things last, in the end of your documentary, of course, you talk about, as a type of conclusion, you talk about what we should be striving for, and of course, the obvious idea is to try to get some sort of independent inquiry or independent commission, but you do raise the question of the Inquiries Act of 2005. So perhaps for people out there who may not be familiar with this and how this all has led to this point, perhaps you can go through what is possible at this point in terms of independent investigations, or whether it's not really feasible under the current Parliamentary Act structure.
Well, sure. I think part of the reason why we have the Inquiries Act is because of Gladio, in part, and also the collusion in Northern Ireland. In both of these situations, across Western Europe, and I mean, the Northern Irish thing was almost a carbon copy of Gladio, but within the context of British politics, it was a very, very similar kind of process that was going on. You had state infiltrators, people working for security services, undercover police, whatever, infiltrating terrorist groups and manipulating them into carrying out attacks against desirable targets or for other political, strategic, black ops reasons, psychological warfare reasons a lot of the time. And what happened is, in the 1990s, Gladio was rather comprehensively exposed. Now we have tons of stuff. We have three different parliamentary inquiries, we have whistleblowers, we have government documents, we have all sorts of things that we can use to demonstrate that this was going on. And a similar sort of thing has happened with Northern Ireland. We have actually had a series of relatively strong investigations into this issue of collusion. Now, all of them have pulled punches to some extent, but they're always going to, so that's that. But at the same time, they have made some very graphic, very explicit statements about what was going on here. And one of the ways that the British state seems to have responded to this threat of investigation was the establishment of the Inquiries Act in 2005. And this was passed, I think it was exactly a month before 7-7, funnily enough. And it basically says that the political leaders, so in this case, it would probably be the Home Secretary, the head of the Home Office in Britain, who would be responsible for setting up this inquiry, would also be responsible for setting its terms of reference, for defining who was staffing it, who was actually on the commission or investigative panel or whatever, and could also determine what can and cannot be investigated. So, for example, they could set up a public inquiry looking into intelligence failures. They could say, why was it that MI5 did not stop these four men from carrying out the attacks? But of course, the terms of reference completely presume that those four men did carry out the attacks. So all of the evidence and all of the questions that suggest otherwise could just be completely ignored. It also establishes this, the Inquiries Act establishes the ability of ministers to close down inquiries at any point, basically without giving any notice, without even having to give reasons to the House of Commons why they've shut the inquiry down. And we've seen examples of this happening. There was a, you may be familiar with the BAE Systems Inquiry, British Aerospace Systems, who do a lot of, basically they're a military contractor. They make military equipment. They build fighter jets and whatever and sell them to Saudi Arabia. And there were lots of allegations, as there would be, that there was corruption, that there was bribery, that this whole thing had been, you know, done almost on the black market. And this is all probably very true. This is, of course, how the international arms industry works. There was an inquiry into it, and I think it was back when Tony Blair was Prime Minister. He just arbitrarily one day decided to shut it down. Clearly they'd got too close to something that would embarrass him or whoever else, his paymasters, etc. And he just shut it down. And he never really gave a reason for this, and he took a bit of flack in the press, but after a few weeks they just forgot about it, and it's now been consigned to the scrap pile. And so a very similar thing could happen with 7-7. And that's why I think that independent investigation is all the more important. It becomes more important when the state becomes incapable of doing it itself. Because to be honest, even if the state wanted to do a proper inquiry into 7-7, right now they probably couldn't, because that legislation almost makes it a certainty that the inquiry would be shut down as soon as it asked the wrong question. So in the absence of the state being able to hold itself to account, or us being able to force the state to hold itself to account, we have to do the job. And that's why I make films, and that's why I sort of promote the July 7th Truth campaign, and why I very much recommend that people go and visit their blogs and visit their websites. And you know, that's a great place to start your investigation, because they've compiled so much information on this. It's truly amazing how much information they've got, given that there's only a few people working, you know, voluntarily doing this. But there again, there are other things that they have not found the time to look into properly, or have, you know, not really considered because of whatever reason, to be honest. So watch my films as well, and also do a lot of your own research, and do your own analysis, and ask your own questions, because that way, at the very least, I mentioned the three sort of aims of all of this. At the very least, we can achieve the third one. We can get a large number of people to be skeptical about what they're being told now, so that when something like this happens in the future, they are skeptical about it straight away. Even if we can't get a new police investigation, even if we can't get a sort of well-funded and well-resourced citizens investigation, what we can do is affect public opinion. Is we can change their minds about it and change their attitudes about it. And if that's all we can accomplish, then I still think we will have accomplished a great thing.
Absolutely. Well, I suppose I do share that fundamental underlying optimism of what is capable and what people out there are capable of, each and every person listening to this interview, let alone the person being interviewed. So I do hope that people do take that to heart. And in that spirit, I suppose, once again, of course, I would like to commend people to your documentary, 7-7 Seeds of Deconstruction and 7-7 Crime and Prejudice, but also to your blog, where you do write some commentary that, of course, is not in the documentaries. Can you tell people about that and where they can go to find it?
Well, I mean, the blog's on Blogspot. It's called Howard Beale's News Hour. You can just type that into Google and or Scroogle or whatever, and it'll pop straight up. And I use that for things that I think are better presented through words than are through video. Video is a particular medium, writing is a particular medium, they have their own strengths and weaknesses. So some of my analysis that didn't make it into the film is on the blog, and obviously some of the stuff that isn't on the blog is in the film. So yeah, feel free to go and look at that. And especially I try and provide as much source material on it as possible in terms of URL links to files or to videos or other documentaries or documents or whatever, you know, whatever it is that we're talking about. So don't just use it as a kind of place to get some informed opinion. I'd like to think I have an informed opinion. But also use it as a place to pick up some further leads and some further source material so you can look at this yourself and ask these questions for yourself and go through this process. Because, you know, I am just one person. I could have got a lot of things wrong here. I hope I haven't, but I could have. And the more people who are looking into this, the more likelihood there is of us covering all the bases and of therefore eventually being able to get to the information so we can establish the truth. And I feel that 7-7 is somewhat underrated and somewhat kind of underexamined in that respect. A lot of the time it's treated as the kind of little brother of 9-11. And much as I kind of appreciate why that is and understand and even agree to some extent, I think that it also warrants investigation on its own merits.
Absolutely. Well, Tom Secker, always a thoughtful and interesting conversation, and again, a very well-researched and very interesting documentary. So thank you once again for taking the time to talk with us, and good luck with your future work.
Thank you, James. Good talking to you, as ever.